We don't have to have everybody under this burden of debt. We don't have to have everybody being drained in terms of their work, in terms of their hopes, in terms of their strength in the future by this fiat machine.
People cannot afford housing. They cannot afford real estate. They cannot afford to own land.
Not everyone in the family holds Bitcoin. It's okay as long as someone in the family has some.
When we have a Bitcoin standard now, the whole house prices will crash down. And when you see it in Bitcoin terms, they are already crashing.
Yes, we are seeing that. Collapse.
Why especially for Africans, why especially for Kenyans is Bitcoin so important in your view?
In my view, it's that Bitcoin is, first of all, a hedge against inflation and currency depreciation, in the sense that we've seen the Kenyan shilling losing its, you know, purchasing power over the last couple of decades ever since independence. And there's been no trusted way to actually hedge against, you know, some of these, you know, depreciations that hit us without a warning. So even if for people who try to do, you know, business, let's say they're in agriculture or they're in, you know, in the financial markets trying to build their wealth through stocks, the impact of the loss of purchasing power is the same. And this fuels so many contentions in terms of strife. We've seen violence, especially with land cases and court cases dragging on for years so that people aren't even able to enjoy the land that they were either supposed to inherit or they've tried to buy after working so hard to, you know, store their value and create a financial haven for themselves. So in my case, it's that I see Bitcoin as that alternative store of value that does not inspire violence or does not trigger violence. In people can earn it and people can save in it without much of a hassle. And it's pretty much the best that we have for now and actually going forward.
That's amazing. And what's the situation like there? Do you have, like, with real estate, some law that taxes it every year? What's the inflation rate there? Is it like, how high is it? How high is the pain?
How high is the pain? Let me use Nairobi, the capital city, as an example. So let's say in 2005 or early 2000s, you could get a property for about 400,000 shillings. If today's dollar equivalent, that would be give or take $2,500. But now we are talking about a property in Nairobi being no less than 11 million shillings. So that's on the lower side. If you're talking about buying land in areas like Kilimani or Kileleshwa, which are pretty prime and close to the you know, operational headquarters for government and for international bodies, we're talking about land being in the valuation of 100 million shillings, 200 million shillings. So for the average person who is earning less than, let's say, $1,000 a month, that is unaffordable. So they are forced to rent, right? But now, in terms of owning land, that if we convert that 100 million shillings or 200 million shillings in a dollar equivalent, we're talking about 900K plus, and that's not affordable for anyone who's starting or looking to earn or to own property in their capital city. If we're looking at the suburbs, property prices have gone up from the basics of like 50,000 shillings back in the, you know, early 2000s to now being 2 million, 5 million, 7 million shillings. And unless someone is either in business or they're looking to, you know, inherit some of these properties from their parents, then it's becoming increasingly expensive and unaffordable for even just someone who's getting out of college. If we can, you know, if you can just chart a path, if you've cleared college, you've gotten your first job, it could take forever, even possibly be impossible to own property in Nairobi and its suburbs.
Yeah, it's fascinating for me, the real estate topic. And I think it's like all over the world, the same problem. People cannot afford housing. They cannot afford real estate. They cannot afford to own land. And then we come to this really interesting topic where Bitcoin probably, in my view, will demonetize all of real estate. Real estate has a utility value, and on top of that is like 20x of the monetary value of their monetary premium, let's say, on top of that, which is amazing. When we have a Bitcoin standard now, the whole house prices will crash down. And when you see it in in Bitcoin terms, they are already crashing. Like with when you calculate the real estate prices, also in Kenya, over the last 5 to 10 years, you will see they're crashing down. All the housing prices are crashing down and actually getting more affordable in Bitcoin terms. If you save in the fiat currency, of course they're getting up. And which is amazing to think about, right?
It's actually awesome to think about it because if I needed, for example, 100 Bitcoin to own my dream home, and now I need probably less than 10 Bitcoin, then it's quite profound if I have to think about it that way, because I don't have to price my my long-term goals and my dreams in terms of an increasing number of millions. In terms of if I wanted, let's say, 5 million initially, then I need 10 million, and so on and so forth. Then it's not about me working harder. It's about me pricing or placing my work in Bitcoin terms, because that's how life becomes more valuable and even more abundant, if I may think about it that way. Because if on a fiat standard I had to, work so hard and do so many things, then it puts a tax on my time, it puts a tax on my energy, it puts a tax on my relationships and my health, because those are the things that people end up losing in the long term. But on a Bitcoin standard, if I need less Bitcoin, then my approach to work changes completely.
Yeah, amazing. And I think we need to, and that's why I'm so bullish on education of Bitcoin. And that's why I'm also asking a lot, what's the like the common misconceptions, the common hurdles that you have to go through when you speak with people outside of Bitcoin? What are they not understanding about Bitcoin? Like what do we have to get better across to no-coiners that don't have Bitcoin, they don't, but they should have Bitcoin. They have problems which Bitcoin will solve. What do you think are the main misconceptions in their head about Bitcoin?
Thank you for that. Allow me to start with the era of scams that hit Kenya especially 2016 to 2018. So when the scams came on board, they promised daily returns, and they created this aura that people could get rich quite fast. And since there was little awareness of Bitcoin at the time, many people put in their savings, and some even took credit or loans to buy what they thought was Bitcoin at the time, only to realize that they were part of a multi-level marketing entity. And these entities keep changing their names over time. So it's the scam just changes, but the scam name changes, but the scam is the same. They promise daily returns. They say that you'll have a share of something of mining, and they tend to use that mining word a lot. Then they also insist that, the more people you bring on board, the more credits you get. So the misconceptions have stuck on that foundation of scamming, that if I buy Bitcoin, I should be getting daily returns, which is not true. The second misconception is that you will get rich quickly, which is also not true, because for Bitcoin, you need patience and that low time preference, that it's not about buying this now and selling it tomorrow. It's not a dealer approach. Yes, you can use it for payments, but it's not something that you're looking to profit from tomorrow. So that's one of the big traps that have kept people from understanding Bitcoin. Then another one is that, not the last one per se, that it's not exactly legal, it's not exactly safe, which is not true. It's perfectly permissionless, that you don't need like a legal entity to permit you to use a transact Bitcoin. So in Kenya, there's a circular notice, a cautionary notice that was issued by the central bank in 2015. And since that time, the limit has been, and the restriction on banks is that they cannot facilitate any Bitcoin transaction directly. But that has not been the limit for people to buy Bitcoin, because there are peer-to-peer networks that allow people to transact through mobile money or now other peer networks. So if the fact that anyone can actually easily buy Bitcoin in Kenya, even over like 5 minutes, it's that you don't need to go through so many hurdles, because I think that's the other hurdle that, or that's the other limit that people think, that you need to know someone, you have to have someone opening an account for you, or that you need to go through a very long process to own Bitcoin. Those things are not true. It's that it's a simple process. So for me, education is a big deal, because I'm sometimes struck by how profound it is that if you tell someone and you actually show them how to open a wallet, how to buy their first Bitcoin within minutes, then you can actually see that they, you know, they begin to warm up to it, that they didn't need to go through a very long process to get their first Bitcoin.
Yeah, amazing. And how did you get over those hurdles? Like, did you discover Bitcoin with the scams, before the scams? How did you go through that process?
I was fortunate actually to know about Bitcoin before the scams. So I heard about it in a documentary. A friend of mine sent me a link to it in 2016. And there happened to be one forum in Nairobi that was hosted the second weekend of September 2016. So when I attended, and they, you know, they spoke about Bitcoin as the, you know, future of money, and it's a, you know, it's a monetary network. At the time, it was around $600, if I remember right. But what didn't make sense to me was that I'm giving $600 to someone I don't know. So that was the, I'll say, the introductory part. But as I got to learn more about it in 2017, 2018 as well, I had the benefit of attending meetups and forums where people were talking about it, people were asking questions. I also attended some of the scam forums, and I found that they were not making sense, because they, you know, their numbers just didn't add up. And I had the benefit of learning by then, so I didn't buy in. I bought my first Bitcoin in 2019. And that's now after I felt comfortable, you know, understanding the basics of the bear market, the bull market, why the price came down. I understood enough now to just buy it on my own. And I felt awesome to just, you know, have my first ownership of Bitcoin.
Amazing, amazing. And you are also big on Austrian economics, right? I saw some tweets of yours. Was it you?
Yes.
What do you think of, like, I'm always keen on Austrian economics, because I'm from Austria, but unfortunately, Austrian economics has nothing to do with the actual Austrian economic situation right now. But it's always interesting for me to see that Austrian economics is such a popular theme in Bitcoin, which makes me glad that I'm Austrian, and that some time in the past there were bright Austrians that have some economic views that are now implemented with Bitcoin. What do you think of Austrian economics? Is it like, did you discover it before Bitcoin, and what's your take on it?
So yes, I did discover it before Bitcoin. I had my undergraduate as a Bachelor of Science in Economics. So I had, let me call it, a bit of an unfair advantage, just understanding the micro, macro principles theory. Now, in the course of studying, I remember feeling a sense of disconnect. Like, yes, we're studying about, for example, Austrian economics as a, you know, as a preferred or superior way in terms of economic thought. But what I could see, for example, in implementation of government policy would leave out so many things that you wonder, okay, we are studying economics as a discipline or as an area of study, right? But how do we link up with the policy? Because the people who are in elective positions end up making the decisions, right? So I realized that I needed to just read more, engage more, and just understand how things work, because it's easy to get stuck between the ideal of how things should be and the actual reality of how politics affects the economy.
Okay. And this is something which always amazes me when we talk about Bitcoin, how I also studied in Austria economics, but there was nothing with Austrian economics actually, which is quite amazing. You are you probably also had more Keynesian economics in your studies.
Yes.
How did you overcome this? Like, did your did your study actually help you in understanding Bitcoin? You said you have an unfair advantage in understanding it, but was it actually influencing your study of Bitcoin then?
So at the time, if I may, kind of step back in time, I put what I studied to the test, right? Now getting into the world of work and now seeing how things go pretty much, how people step into influence, how elections are carried out, how, for example, in Kenya, then we see the transfer of power, let's say it's quite connected to certain communities more than others. It made me question a lot of things. And in the process of questioning, I would say that it helped me realize that in as much as there's an idealized view of the world or principles that would actually guide it in a certain way, there are limits in terms of the realities. Because if we, for example, see the thinking around government fiat, it's supposed to be that we should trust the government to do right by the resources and the power that it has, right? And we keep seeing the ideal being pushed out that this is supposed to happen, that is supposed to happen, this is supposed to happen, healthcare should be this way, education should be this way, energy should be, it should be affordable and so on and so forth. But in the reality, then we see an abuse of trust, an abuse of authority in the sense that one policy going after another policy that disempowers people or that makes the cost of living higher or that makes life quite more difficult for the average citizen. Then this disparity, I think, is where our discussion needs to dwell, because it's not so much about the ideals that we keep, but the reality that we need to deal with.
Amazing. Do you think when you take this whole context of what you just said, is then El Salvador a role model in accepting Bitcoin and implementing a sound money system, or what could have El Salvador done better? I mean, I don't know if you have been to El Salvador.
I haven't been to El Salvador yet, but I love the initiative that they have taken in terms of the risk, first of all, and the boldness to stand by their commitment to implement, Bitcoin, legalized, I would say, currency in their country, but putting their money where their mouth is, in terms of even the bonds, how they've appreciated. I think their milestones will be worth studying for nations. And in as much as they will be opposition to adopting a Bitcoin standard, that opposition is okay. I think future leaders, young leaders, myself and my peers, we are the ones who are stepping into these positions of influence. So it's not about even just seeing what El Salvador has done, but taking the risk and putting our money where our mouth is, not just trying to fix the old system, but stepping into this new one, because trying to fix the old system increasingly becomes untenable. So if I may use the recent policy in terms of the dollar, the rate hikes. Since the Kenya shilling is pegged to the dollar, whatever happens to the dollar tends to be amplified in the shilling. So, for example, if we try to fix policy in Kenya, then it becomes a matter of understanding what's going on in the US, what's happening to the dollar. Because if we can't touch that, then there's very little we can do to save the shilling or have an impact in terms of its improvement.
Do you see a possibility where when we have, like, I think it's clear that fiat currency will collapse. Like that, I think there's no way around that. I mean, it's collapsing since like so many years, so many decades, and it will continue to collapse and eventually maybe even fade out or crash completely. But as an alternative, maybe governments, or do you see as an alternative to that, that maybe governments say, let's try it again with gold. Let's again find a gold standard, buy more gold, peg it 1 to 2, 1 to 3. Do you think this is a possibility where government saying gold is again the asset and then regain the trust in fiat currency and paper money?
I think they will try, and in all that is within their means, they will try, because gold is that safe haven that they have trusted for years. However, the question in this is that how much gold will be enough to save any of the fiat currencies around the world, right? How much gold will be enough for one currency to not have to outprice or have an unfair advantage over another, right? It could actually create now more tension in terms of gold holdings in the different countries, and it still leads to that that scarcity and that tension in between nations in terms of who will trust who to back up another. And it still comes back to the same quagmire that we have right now with fiat currencies. So if I may use like Kenya's situation as an example, Kenya is technically a net importer, meaning that we import most of the goods and the services that we need in the economy. So that's why earning dollars is quite a big deal. So unless, for example, we fix the fundamentals of business, just people being able to earn income or export their goods and their services, then people still need dollars to import. And by the time, for example, we need or we have multilateral agreements, for example, with Ethiopia or India or any other country that we're doing business with and agree to settle with them in their currencies or in our currency, that's still a long shot. We're not escaping the fundamental exposure to the dollar. And one other strain, for example, on the economy is the extent of loans and credits that are on an increasing amount against the GDP. So it still calls for a form of control on the fundamentals, because if we keep borrowing, then we'll still need more dollars. And unfortunately, if the solution for now is to tax people, then it still creates a chokehold on businesses. So the fundamental is to fix the business environment and let it generate enough revenue, at least for people to just meet their needs, pay their staff, and just have the right environment to be more productive, instead of being choked by policies and taxes and more loans. It's not a healthy cycle.
Yeah, and in addition to that, they have also to adopt a sound money standard, right? When a business is running, even if a business is really doing good and they are running good and customers come in, but if they save in currency that is just depleting of value, in the end of the day, they don't have anything from that, right? It's fascinating to see. When we see now a little bit in the future, and I know today I released a podcast about that, and why also people choose to stay private in Bitcoin. Like, we are obviously with our face and we say Bitcoin is good, and we are obviously outspoken Bitcoiners, but there are also a lot of Bitcoiners that want to stay anonymous, and their thesis usually is that they think that Bitcoin will be really successful and that fiat will collapse and not a lot of people will jump on to Bitcoin soon enough, and therefore it will cause some social drama, some social threats to Bitcoiners. Do you think we're running in the risk, if fiat is collapsing too fast and Bitcoin is rising too fast, that there could be social things happening where Bitcoiners will be attacked, where privacy and non-KYC is really important?
Yes, fundamentally it's that Bitcoiners, especially for Bitcoiners who stay anonymous, I have learned and have been part of a few discussions where the concern about being publicly identified as a Bitcoiner is increasingly becoming a risk, because let's say in the last 10 years or 15 years of Bitcoin's existence, you could be dismissed, right? You're a Bitcoiner, I don't care, what's that? You're probably being associated with being like a shady person or a cypherpunk somewhere or a criminal, but they could dismiss you. But now they're interested, like, wait a minute, you're talking about Bitcoin, you say you hold Bitcoin, now they want to know how much. So the shift in that becomes quite interesting, because yes, safety is a big deal. And that's why we've seen, for example, on X, a common phrase that, like, I lost my Bitcoin in a boating accident, or I lost my Bitcoin in this way, or a phishing attack or something. I do believe some of them are genuine losses, and I do understand that some of them are very safe ways for people to just disconnect their public, image and personality from actual holding of Bitcoin, right? But for Bitcoiners, it's definitely going to be important to just be smart about their storage, be it. And I think we have amazing options for cold storage right now. So it's going to be, yes, a matter of safety and concern, and I agree with that. So the other thing is that in terms of fiat collapsing, it's that, yes, we are seeing the collapse. I think the thing that is a bit of an unforeseen event is governments actually doing everything they can to stop the societal collapse. And I know we don't talk about this enough, but faith in people, I think we need to, in as much as there's the doom of fiat collapsing and the risk of it having so many ripple effects in society, I believe in the resilience of people, because in as much as people see the, you know, the hardship, the adversity, and the things that are against them right now, the resilience of the human spirit is so powerful that we need to, as Bitcoiners, also speak to the faith of humanity that, yes, we can see the systems are against us, but that doesn't mean they stop us and they disempower us completely. Because in terms of that equation, then, people can still unite. People can still stand up for each other. People can still hold fort for their loved ones, because it's not so much about saving everyone or saving everything from collapse, but standing where you are or standing where I am. Because if I can stand for my family, if you can stand for your loved ones, then I think there is hope, in as much as we are seeing the risks of fiat collapsing and putting so much threat and strain on our societies.
21 Bitcoin is Bitcoin only from day one, and they teach and preach self-custody. This is my go-to exchange when someone asks me, oh, where can I buy my Bitcoin from? This is the easiest entry for Bitcoiners. And if you want lower fees, plus at the same time support this podcast, use code Robin and click the link in the description.
It's very beautiful what you just said. Thank you for that. And I think it's also and task of every Bitcoiner when he gets Bitcoin or she gets Bitcoin, that we are thinking of our loved ones next. Like, who do I really love? Who's in my family? Like my parents, my brother, sister, my family, my girlfriend, boyfriend, my wife, whatever. We have to also care for them, not only in like a love and caring way, but also in a financial way. We have to see, how can I ensure that they are onboarded on Bitcoin and that they are on the right ship, not on the fiat ship, they are on the Bitcoin ship. When shit hits the fan, we probably need that. And so I'm staking not only really, really hard for myself, but also for my family. I have a really big family and a lot of them don't get Bitcoin. So I have to stack a lot in order to care for them. And yeah, and Bitcoin gives us hope, right? It's something that gives humanity and individuals something to look forward to, because if we did not have Bitcoin, what do we have, right? What would you do right now without Bitcoin?
It's a powerful question, and I think I was reading about something recently that students and teenagers are opting for skill-based work, like either ship sharing or plumbing, and taking care of farms instead of going to college. And we've seen the extent of the student loan burden in so many countries, that you're owning, if you owe a couple thousand dollars or $100,000 in debt as a student, you're already set back in life, because not everybody gets the kind of work or opportunity to pay off that debt. We've seen people in their late years, their sunset years, still owing student debt. I think that's terrible. So if students are opting early to just opt out of the system, then there is hope. It's a message. I mean, enough people are seeing that instead of, not having a work guarantee because you have a degree, it only makes sense for you to start looking at ways for you to make income for yourself without so much debt over your head, right? And if people opt out enough, I think it's going to be a critical tipping point. And that's why I feel like in as much as we are, as Bitcoiners and people who are able to see how things go, we're able to question, society and trends, direction and government. In as much as we're able to ask these questions, then we need to begin to speak into the hope of humanity that we don't have to have everybody under this burden of debt. We don't have to have everybody being drained in terms of their work, in terms of their hopes, in terms of their strength in the future by this fiat machine, right? Even if it doesn't collapse on its own weight, the thing is that people still have time. People still have hope, right? For example, let me say for my family, not everybody holds or owns Bitcoin, right? But for example, my aunt, I helped her like create her first wallet last year, and it was so fulfilling just to see her, opting in. And yes, I would love everybody in my family to, have their own holding of Bitcoin. But if we too are the ones, just as we've mentioned, are the ones who are looking out for our family, then perhaps the adoption of Bitcoin doesn't need to be that everyone is individually adopting Bitcoin, but someone in every family having at least a holding of Bitcoin, because that's a better shot at the future than us trying to get, everybody at once, right? That may not work out. And if I may link this, for example, to the idea of number go up, and, we're trying to see, we're looking at this future of Bitcoin worth so much more than it is right now. That's awesome. But are we, let's say, in each family, increasing the amount of Bitcoin that we have? And for me, that's changed like how I approach the education efforts that I put in, because if, for example, we just speak into the hope of humanity and just bring out the best of people, then put in that aspect that if not everyone in the family holds Bitcoin, it's okay, as long as someone in the family has some, that's a better shot at the future.
Yeah, amazing. And I'm also seeing it in my family, where a few years back when I came into Bitcoin, I was the only one. And now there are some cousins, there are some uncles, there are my dad and stuff like that, who also get Bitcoin, like they have Bitcoin and they get it. So I'm enjoying getting the big family table, and more orange people are in there. So I'm liking the conversation and the progress there. We talked about now, like, what if there's no Bitcoin, but, there is Bitcoin, luckily, and we have this hope. And what are you, doing in the Bitcoin community, right now?
Right now, I'm focusing on education, because it still comes back to that all the effort toward economy and better regulatory support or more partnerships coming on, for example, in Kenya, it's centered on education. And I have on different occasions just settled back toward that foundation. So it's quite something that I'm doubling down upon this year.
Amazing, amazing, yeah. Perfect. Then this was already a lot and really, really cool. Thank you for that. Are you actually using also, I'm just curious what you're doing, and do you use value for value platforms like Nostra, Fountain, and stuff like that?
At the risk of, being grilled by the Bitcoin community, I'm not yet on Nostra, but I know I should put in some effort to build a reputation there. But I've been. I think for me, my learning curve has gone pretty high in the last year or so.
Yeah, it's. I'm actually also not directly on Nostra. My podcast is on Fountain, so people can find me kind of on Nostra, because Fountain will get integrated with Nostra, or is integrated with Nostra already. I heard from the founder there. I'm always curious what people are doing at the moment, maybe even outside of Bitcoin. Like, what are you currently studying and learning about, which is, it can be about Bitcoin, it can be outside of Bitcoin. Like, what are you currently into, which you are really passionate about?
Oh, that's an awesome one. I think psychology first. I like reading just about how people relate, what motivates them, why they make decisions the way they do. I've been reading quite a lot about that. Tags also on like somatic therapy, shadow work, healthy diet, and just, you know, how to take care of the body in different like blood group types. I know there's been a bit of a discussion / dispute around the blood type diet, so that's one thing I'm currently studying. What else am I looking at study wise? I've been doing a study on the relationship between digital governance as it relates to risk and return. So you see how for Bitcoin you have we have the halving, right? The block height is predetermined, the supply schedule is sure, and it's decentralized as a network. We can identify the number of nodes. Now this is a form of digital governance that over time tends to create a prediction over the risk and return of Bitcoin, such that if we knew, for example, 4 years ago or 8 years ago, that if you have an 8-year hold or an 8-year commitment to hold your Bitcoin, you're better off than someone who is looking at it on a 1-year horizon, because they may look at it, for example, on a post bull market, and for them they'd think that, you know, Bitcoin cannot give returns. But in an 8-year horizon, then they can realize these returns are far more significant than most stock markets or most index funds and most mutual funds and other investment vehicles that people have trusted over the years, right? So I'm building a thesis around that, and in a few months I think I should have a paper ready.
Yeah, which also makes me think of how will governments in general, like how will, when we have Bitcoin and digital governance, how will then governments exist when we have Bitcoin? Did you thought about that? How in like 50, 100 years, maybe when we have a Bitcoin standard, how governments can exist and how different this service or this government system will be in a Bitcoin world?
Yes, I have thought about that. Now, governments, yes, will still exist, could be still in their current form, elective or representative government, because we have the fundamentals of human nature and human interest in hierarchy and power and governance, right? So it's going to be hard for people to switch away from what they have known about form of government. But in terms of money, then the conversation will be different, because in as much as people see the relationship between government funding and government policy, then I think there will be a greater push for accountability in terms of, if these people are elected to make decisions that represent the will of the people and they don't do that, then there will be a greater push and people actually being more involved in government than disinvolved or passive about it. So I think that's one of the things I foresee in the next 50 years, that people will be more interested in the rules and the policies that affect their lives directly. And even if they do not adopt a Bitcoin standard, which will still coexist, it's that they will have the boldness to push for this accountability, because it will be more evident to people, for example, that Bitcoin is transparent, right? The ledger is audited every 10 minutes and we can see the addition of new blocks and the issuance, the transfers and all that. But if we can't see this level of transparency in national budgets and the, you know, the issuance or distribution of resources in a nation, then I think more people will be interested in that, especially if if we know we are paying taxes and these taxes are not being used in the right way, then people will stop sitting back and push for more accountability.
This is, I'm looking forward to this world. as you describe it, I'm like, yes, 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 I want that word. We have an end routine in the podcast, and it has been a pleasure with talking with you. We have an end routine in the podcast where the previous guest is asking a question for the next guest, and the previous guest is El Salvadoriana who is born abroad but then came back to his home country El Salvador because of Nayib Bukele and because of the Bitcoin standard. Then he stayed also there. His question to you was, when are you coming to El Salvador?
Oh, wow. That's a beautiful challenge. Let me see. Let me put the window within the year.
Yeah, a year. Perfect. Yeah, maybe you can come to the Adopting Bitcoin conference in, I think, November it is, because yes. I'm also thinking going there in November to the Bitcoin conference. It would be amazing to see a lot of Bitcoiners there in El Salvador with a lot of high signal and no noise whatsoever, which I'm hoping for. Then thank you, Rosaline, for the interview. It was a pleasure talking with you. If now people want to reach out to you and people want to reach you and ask you questions, where can they reach you the best way?
Can reach me on X. That's my favorite platform for now. And LinkedIn as well. So pretty much those two. And, you know, I think as we follow through on from YouTube, then you can also let me know. And I'll give my contacts to you so that those who want to reach me on email can also reach out to you.
Perfect. Thank you for the interview.
Thank you so much. It's been awesome.